From Melman Consulting, this is 14th and G, the podcast at the intersection of business, politics, and culture, coming to you from the heart of Washington, D.C.
I am thrilled to be joined by Dan Wong to discuss Breakneck, which is currently number 4. I think it's going to keep rising on the New York Times bestseller list. It is an absolutely outstanding book, China's Quest to Engineer the Future. Great on technology, great on China. The great Tyler Cowen on the cover of the book, the best recent book on China and America, and arguably the best book of the year, flat out. Dan, congrats on such a successful launch and welcome.
Bruce, it's a pleasure to be here. Great to chat with a larger group.
So I'll start as most of the people who come to a lot of these know, we bought 100 copies for attendees. We'll send a link somewhere in the next day or two where you can enter your address because other people handle mailing it. But it's a great book and it's well worth the read. We're going to spend a ton of time unpacking the book's big idea. And this is overstated. We'll get into stating it more clearly. But the piece that obviously grabbed the imagination of the Wall Street Journal, The Economist, everywhere is the notion that China's run by engineers and America's run by lawyers. Let's take a quick step back, tell your background and your personal and professional journey that put you in position to observe this before you were able to write it.
I was born in southwest China, in the mountainous part of peripheral China, which was a backwater when my parents were there and remains a backwater today. We moved to Canada when I was little, and subsequently I moved to the burbs of Philadelphia. I was just with my parents last weekend after being in D.C. to speak at the Abundance Conference and spending a bit of time with my parents in Philly before coming to work in Silicon Valley and where I'm speaking to you now from San Francisco, California. I studied philosophy in school. I think I was a very bad student, but a very good philosopher in terms of dropping out after 3 years. Went to go work in tech. I worked for big tech companies that included Shopify as well as Flexport. Met a fellow in the year 2016 by the name of Arthur Kroeber, who started an investment research firm called Govcow Dragonomics, which was serving a financial audience with investment research to get beyond the headlines in the Wall Street Journal or Bloomberg. And I moved to China in 2017 to be the technology analyst. And for the next 6 years, I was in China between 2017 to 2023. I saw the very first trade war under the first Trump administration, the trade war that morphed into a tech war. I saw how Xi consolidated his own power, removed his own term limits, made China more repressive in many ways. And the centerpiece of my experience in China was to live through zero COVID, the entirety of the zero COVID pandemic, from living in Beijing to living in Shanghai. And that was when I decided, perhaps there is a book in all of this, and perhaps I should move back to the US to write it. That's when I moved to the Yale Law School, where I was a fellow at the China Center there, did a lot of thinking about China, published this book. Now I'm a fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford and still thinking very actively about what's going on in China and technology.
Perfect. Thank you. And Bates, I saw that we're not going to talk about the Eagles here today because we're going to keep this civil, just U.S. and China, not Commanders Eagles. Let's walk through the thesis. The big idea, China's run by engineers who build things quickly and who see an engineering solution to every problem. America by lawyers who see a debate and a reason to litigate things and maybe don't even decide what to build. How is this so? How do we get here? And what is so what? What's the difference? What does that mean for where we stand and where we're going?
Yeah. First, let's get to the what, and then let's get to the so what. So first, the what. China, I call an engineering state, because if we take a look at the composition of the most senior members of the Communist Party, so many of them have engineering backgrounds. Starting in the 1980s, Deng Xiaoping really promoted a lot of engineers into the top ranks of China's leadership. These were people who were trained as hydraulic engineers, chemical engineers, mechanical engineers, all sorts of different engineering disciplines. And I think that there is an element that we can trace back into Chinese imperial history as well, in which we take a look at the emperors. What is China really known for? I would submit a couple of things. Running a big imperial exam system in which everybody is given these grades, and then they're ranked, and then they are rotated into manage different projects. Some of these projects include the Great Wall, as well as the Grand Canal, a fortification system in the former case, and a big hydraulic system, waterway system in the latter case. And I think there's a quite similar analog with the United States, where if we take a look at the founding of the United States, something like the Declaration of Independence reads almost like a legal document. First 16 presidents from Washington to Lincoln, 13 of them were lawyers. Most of the founding fathers were lawyers. And even in the present day, if we take a look, especially at the Democratic Party, from 1980 to 2024, every single nominee to be president in the Democratic Party had gone to law school. That's a lot of folks. And if we take a look at the U.S. Senate today, there's 47 senators who have degrees in law, and only one of them have any plausible degree that resembles a STEM field. Okay, what does this mean? Now let's get to the so what. I think what this means is that China is a country that treats building another big mega project as the solution to pretty much all of its problems. Whenever the economy trembles out of some sort of weakness, the Politburo is really keen to announce a really big building project again. And so China, as I document in my book, has gone through these vast spasms of construction over the last four decades, which it built so much high-speed rail, so many highways, so many hyperscalers, homes, coal plants, solar, wind, you name it. China has been building it, and it's not really slowing down, even though China is now fairly well built up. Unfortunately, China is also made up of not only physical engineers, but also social engineers, in which they treat society as almost just another building material to be remolded and torn down as the leadership wishes. That's why I spend a lot of time thinking about the one-child policy as well as zero COVID, which the numbers right there in the name. There's no ambiguity about what these mean. And the so what when it comes to the United States is that I think lawyers are much better at obstruction than construction. For the most part, lawyers are good at saying no. They have a lot of means to say no. And what we're seeing is that I think the United States has basically not very functional infrastructure almost anywhere in the country. There's been a big shortage of homes throughout the country. And we don't have stupid ideas like the one-child policy, but I would really like it if our trains were able to move a little bit more quickly and if our subways were a bit more quiet.
So let me ask you a sort of a spin on the Noah Smith, the great Noah Smith, who's I know your friend and a huge fan of yours. But when we take a look, first, it's not like the U.S. has never built stuff. We built extraordinary things. We have 200 years of being the best, arguably, in the world. It's a more recent phenomenon that we seem to start tripping over ourselves and over-lawyering things, arguably in the 70s. So it's a 50-year failure. And Noah Smith asked that maybe instead of this being a deep-rooted engineer versus lawyer culture thing, it's a developmental cycle thing, that we used to build a lot of stuff, but now worrying about due process, worrying about human rights as a more developed society where thankfully we don't require 321 million abortions through the one-child policy, but we maybe let some construction take too long. What's your answer to Noah's take that maybe China is just earlier on the development cycle and that maybe they're going to end up in a similar spot?
Yeah, I think Noah absolutely has a point here. And I think the way that I would see it is that there's not just one cycle in which, you know, you build out a lot and then you kind of stagnate. I see several different cycles going on. So first, I think it's worth addressing, Bruce, that you're absolutely right that lawyers have been part of America for a while. And yet the U.S. has been at points an engineering state. And I think throughout basically this 100-plus year period between 1850 to 1950, the U.S. built so many great things. America built these amazing skyscrapers in Chicago, as well as New York. It built the Transcontinental Railroad. It built the canal systems through upstate New York, built the highway projects. It built Manhattan, Apollo, and all sorts of amazing things. And a lot of that had stopped throughout the 1960s and the 1970s for excellent reasons, because America overbuilt, because urban planners like Robert Moses had rammed through these highways in New York City, because a lot of people had become exhausted with the Vietnam War, because the U.S. Department of Agriculture was spraying DDT and pesticides absolutely everywhere. And a lot of these had to be stopped. And it was good that someone like Ralph Nader came along, pointed out that the government was a little bit too cozy with the automotive companies, and there should have been a degree of correction to introduce more processes to stop folks like Robert Moses as well. And I think what we need right now is a correction against the correction. I think we've overcorrected on the side of lawyers. The lawyers that in FDR's day used to be more like deal makers that stacked his New Deal cabinet with a lot of lawyers, they were Wall Street lawyer types. They were trying to figure out how to raise bonds for railroads and then building railroads themselves by turfing people out of their homes with eminent domain. But they were deal makers first and foremost. They were creative and trying to get stuff done. And then throughout the 1960s and 70s, the Ralph Nader types took over, which law students were much more interested in becoming regulators as well as litigators. And I think right now, given all of the problems that the U.S. faces, I think that the U.S. has to introduce a little bit more of its engineering talents into the system again. The U.S. obviously needs a lot of homes, especially in bigger cities like New York and San Francisco and Boston. And the U.S. Obviously needs to update some parts of its infrastructure, especially the highway system, as well as the train system. And this is all before we have to build out a lot more energy capacity, especially on solar, wind, and nuclear to decarbonize our economy. And so when we add all of these things up together, I don't think it's a simple story that you build a lot of infrastructure, you're kind of done, and then the lawyers can take over. I think it is good for lawyers to take over for a while, but they need to cede a little bit of power back to the engineers once more.
So let's stick with the U.S. Before I want a whole lot of questions about China, and this book probably is much more about China. But you talk about how we lost process knowledge. And I mentioned that we had Patrick McGee on talking about Apple in China, which is the story, I felt like, of process knowledge and how it was I don't want to say transferred, but shared in China and developed in China. What I wonder about it is thinking about sort of American rejuvenation. Is process knowledge like a muscle we're out of shape and we've got to tone it back up? Or that really flattering towards you review in the Wall Street Journal suggested, or is it like an amputated limb that won't grow back? What's your take on America's capability in the globally competitive world where China is now the dominant manufacturer to get back to having that process knowledge, which requires time and effort?
Yeah. So first, let me define what process knowledge is. So I think that when we take a look at what technology is, what I came to a conclusion after spending quite a few years in China was that we may be understating some of the most important parts of technology. So the first component of technology is tooling and equipment. These are things that we can see, observe, probably poke at. And in a kitchen analogy that I like to use, this is the pots, pans, and the stove, all of the equipment that we use to cook things. The second part of technology is written instruction. So these are patents, these are blueprints, these are the recipes, everything that we can codify and write down and share with other people. And the third and most important part of process knowledge is of technology is process knowledge, which is essentially everything else that cannot be written down, that cannot be codified into some sort of an equipment. And that can also be referred to as tacit knowledge, industrial experience, all of these things that are really difficult to measure. And I think this is the most important part of what technology actually is, because if we give someone a superbly equipped kitchen, as well as the most exquisitely detailed recipe, we can't be sure that if they don't have any cooking experience, that they're able to cook something as simple as fried eggs or scrambled eggs for breakfast. They may well burn the kitchen down if they haven't really cooked an omelet before. And so I think this is the crucial part of what America has lost over quite a few decades. I typically live in Michigan. My wife is a professor at the University of Michigan. We're surrounded by the Midwestern industrial heartland, which has lost a lot of jobs. I'm really glad, Bruce, that you bring up Patrick McGee. I'm seeing him for lunch in San Francisco in 2 days. I think he has written a superb book, just showing the extent to which Apple has shipped off a lot of jobs to China, and then introduced a lot of process knowledge into the Chinese industrial workforce. And one of these thought experiments that I like to offer is, what if Apple declined to build its iPhone predominantly in Shenzhen? This sounds like a fantastic scenario, I know, but what if Apple really started to build a lot of its iPhones in 2008 in industrial Midwestern towns in the states of Michigan or Pennsylvania or Wisconsin? I think what we would see if such a fantastic scenario existed would be that a lot of these follow-on innovations of the smartphone, things like consumer drones, things like electric vehicle batteries, all sorts of new battery and electronics technologies, they may spring from Pennsylvania rather than from Shenzhen instead. And so what I think is the most important part of China's technological success so far has been this enormous workforce, substantially trained by foreign companies, not just Apple, but also Tesla, as well as 1,001 big American manufacturers. Some of it is produced by internal competition, but what China has is this super adept, very robust, very flexible workforce that is able to make almost anything in the world. And by continually training this muscle, they are able to continue doing more things. And I certainly hope that the process knowledge in the US is not going to be an amputated limb. I view it as being much closer to being a muscle that, if the US is able to successfully reindustrialize, it is going to be able to train these muscles, do much better, and then build a lot of important things once more.
So let's stay a little bit on this theme, Apple and China adjacent, because a conceit in America for sure is that China cheats. They don't play by the rules, and there's plenty of examples of stolen IP. You subsidize competitors, and they just take out our market players, and then the sort of state-owned or state-supported enterprise owns the market. They bully or bribe foreign buyers. Non-tariff trade barriers at home using state funds. And surely a lot of that has gone on. At the same time, others would say they out-invested and outworked us. Patrick's story, in part, is Foxconn was just willing to work harder, send more people to get STEM degrees, suffer through over-competition as opposed to the market corrective, where we all start going to law school, at least in part, because the opportunities for engineers maybe had been going down. To what degree do you read the state of play as China rigged the WTO and the trade rules to create advantages and thereby game the system? And what percent of this is just they're hungrier and they're willing to bust their tails more and get more STEM students and work for less?
Well, if the question is whether China is engaging in unfair competition or whether they are just really hard workers, I believe the answer is yes. So I think I think there's definitely the case that China has competed unfairly through industrial subsidies, through some degree of IP theft, and even more galling, some of it appears to be state-directed IP theft. In some cases, perhaps taking you have the intelligence agencies from China's figuring out corporate espionage on behalf of firms. I think that is absolutely worth confronting. And at the same time, I think that China has this, again, very robust workforce, extremely competitive market dynamics in which people feel like they have to work hard, not because they want to, but because they gotta. So I have spent quite a bit of time chatting with Chinese companies in China, as well as American companies, European companies competing against Chinese companies. And they will all tell you that Chinese workers, Chinese bosses are working their tails off, and it becomes really difficult to compete with them. I'm thinking a lot about automotive companies now, where it takes about 6 or 7 years to conceptualize of a new model and then bring it to market. And so, they're working on companies like Ford or Toyota or Volkswagen, maybe working on these 6, 7 year cycles. For the Chinese, they're working on cycles that are closer to being 18 months, or 18 months to 24 months. And so that is just at the very least 3 times faster than the Americans and the Europeans and the Japanese. And so I don't think this is anything unfair about that scale of competition. I think that is because a lot of American companies, Western companies, have just been generally pretty complacent. I think that there's an element in which you have to be super competitive in China because you have a lot of competitors, and that's just all there is. I remember visiting an internet company in Beijing in 2018. It was a company by the name of Meituan. It had already grown quite successful then, and now it's one of China's most successful internet companies. And part of the founding myth, founding lore of Meituan was that at the time it started, it was one of 5,000 clones to Groupon. So there were just 5,000 companies doing exactly the same business model. And out of this battle royale of 5,000 companies, it managed to survive and it managed to beat this competition. And so you got to imagine how ruthless this management is, how competitive its workers are. And I still feel that more of these dynamics are driving forward tech progress in China rather than anything to do with the state in terms of subsidies or theft. That's not where I would place the predominance of credit.
All right, so let's turn to the tariff showdown of this year, because something this is both your book, but also just as a guy who's observed and watched tech competition for a long time. How was the U.S. possibly surprised by our rare earth vulnerabilities? I mean, hasn't China been openly, explicitly advertising their plan to become less reliant on us and make us more dependent on them? I thought your book talked about President Xi has like this. In 2015, he said, here's the game plan, and rare earths was on the map. And yet we find ourselves in 2025 like, oh, gosh, we're dependent on them and they're not as bad on us. How did this come about when it feels like we've had 10 years of heads up?
I think there are certainly parts of the American government that understood quite well that China owns all of these rare earths, and rare earth magnets are crucial components in everything like automotives and clean technology and all sorts of defense equipment as well. But I think we had a bit of ideology within the Trump administration early on. I'm thinking a lot about a particular remark from Secretary of Treasury Scott Bessent, in which he said, we have the market. They have the goods, and if we can hurt them a lot more, then they can hurt us. And Bessent's words were, they're playing with a pair of twos and we have a pair of aces, because Bessent believed that it is the market that is supreme. If we deny them the market, if we deny them the ability to export, then they're going to fold because there are so many problems here. And I think, having spent quite a lot of time in China, after having seen the COVID experience in the U.S., when a lot of folks got quite angry that they couldn't get basic goods, they couldn't get furniture, they couldn't get all sorts of consumer electronics because of lockdowns, in which the part of your grocery store failed, depending on which part of Mexico was hit with tariffs and which part of Mexico was producing which sort of berries. I think that the U.S. has just not thought enough about the supply side for a very long time. And I think this is sort of the delusion that Bessent and other people in the administration also labored under, in which they thought, okay, it is the market that rules supreme. It is the wallet that determines everything. Rather, I think we're seeing that consumers actually really like their goods, and they don't like it when they can't buy important stuff that they need.
So I hear you, and that seems to check out. I wonder to some degree also whether or not we just don't, both we and China were in pain when the trade tariff situation was gone. We don't like pain, and maybe they just, Bessent may be right about the overall importance of the market. China would not do well if they couldn't sell to the United States, but maybe they were better prepared to tough it out a little bit longer. And that leads to my broader question. Do you think China is rising or falling? We've had people like Hal Brands on, who wrote a really interesting book you probably read called Danger Zone. And the theory is, you take a look, they had a real estate bubble. Now it's a factory bubble. Their demographics are terrible. Their environmental situation is not good. They don't have much of a safety net. And that he views it as a danger zone because they realize they've kind of hit peak China and it's going south. To read your old pals at GavCall, there are reasons to feel like, boy, they're cornering some of the really important technologies of the future. They're making a lot of smart decisions. How do you see their setup and where things are headed?
Well, Bruce, if the question is whether China is rising or falling, my answer is yes. And I think that it is always both at the same time. And these are things that are always quite challenging to try to grasp. And one of these things I'm always trying to think of is, if we turn the question around a little bit and ask, is the U.S. right now rising or falling? It is it is always
Yes.
difficult to tell, but the answer is always yes, isn't it? I acknowledge that there are all sorts of problems with China. And to be very clear, one of the decisions I made very happily was that I didn't need to stay in China for much longer. After 6 years in China, after 3 years of being unable to leave and under the zero COVID policy, what I really missed was a sense of pluralism. What I really missed was having these sort of fun, unfiltered conversations with folks like you, Bruce, in which we can really just chat a lot about a lot of stuff without fearing that the censors will come down and stop all of our Zoom accounts from functioning because we said the wrong word on a Zoom. I really like being in a place where there's debate and there's a lot of different voices out there. And I think that there is a very strong sense in which a lot of folks in China are very dispirited. We have rich people leaving, we have creative people leaving. Over 2024, there were tens of thousands of Chinese who were flying to Ecuador to try to walk across the border with other migrants from Central America and South America to try to cross the southwestern border into the United States. It's still kind of stunning to me that there were 40,000 people being apprehended by CBP every month in the southwestern United States because so many Chinese were not very happy with Xi's rule or something else. There's environmental problems, there's demographic problems, there's debt problems, there's all sorts of political instability problems. But one of the provocations that I've enjoyed making now to folks in DC, to folks everywhere, is that something I believe in is that China can win without replacing the United States in terms of power in every respect. I don't think that China will be a cultural powerhouse. I don't think it will be a diplomatic powerhouse. I don't think it will be a financial powerhouse because it is so much ruled by engineers that don't really value things like culture and finances. I think that China. There is one area in which China is doing really, really well, and that is technology, advanced manufacturing, all sorts of goods that we are reading about in sort of the business headlines in the Wall Street Journal. And the case that I want to offer, the little provocation that I want to offer without necessarily endorsing it or believing in it myself, is that China might win by achieving success in science and technology alone. Something that I fear is that as China becomes much better at making automotives, industrial robotics, clean technology, it will further deindustrialize the United States. The U.S. has something like 12 million workers in manufacturing. Right now, President Trump is successfully deindustrializing the U.S. himself. We've seen about 80,000 manufacturing jobs lost since Liberation Day when he announced his tariffs. But imagine if those 12 million manufacturing workers goes down to something like 8 or 7 or 5 million workers. And, we have something like a couple of million manufacturing workers out of jobs. I think that is going to create greater economic dysfunction. And I think that is going to create greater political dysfunction as well. And if China is making all of the goods that are important for, let's say, military competition, these include drones and munitions and ships, all things that the US is no longer very good at actually producing, they might be able to militarily subdue the United States. And so, something I fear is that even if China wins only on one narrow thing, it manages to really mess up Americans in some pretty crucial ways. And I think that is sort of the scenario that I'm most keen to help America avoid.
Well, appreciate having your thoughts and thinking on our side of this because I actually plan to get there in a minute on some questions on the unthinkable, but you need to think. But first, let's before the bullets start flying, if you're advising American investors or American manufacturers, how investable is China? We've seen their willingness to shut down, whether it's Jack Ma or others. They could allow you to invest and then not allow you necessarily to get your money out. Is China still a safe and smart place for Western investors and Western manufacturers to put their money?
It is maybe not a safe place, though there may be, it might be a case that it is a smart place, although I don't endorse that with a great degree of confidence. I would say in general that China is probably not the best place to invest money, in part because of various economic reasons. Bruce, there's a very strange structural quirk with the Chinese stock market. Chinese economic growth, GDP growth, has been a straight line, mostly about on average of 8 or 9% over the last 20 years. That's extremely impressive. What has the stock market done? It's been completely flat on average. And so there are some strange quirks with the Chinese stock market in which there's a lot of lack of profitability. There's a lot of ways in which financial participants kind of game the system. But on average, the stock market returns have not been very high. You pile on top of that all of these geopolitical risks that you mentioned, things like having capital controls that makes it pretty difficult for investors to take their money out, things like decapitating parts of the consumer internet sector, which are such darlings for the market, with very little warning, wiping out trillions of dollars from the market at a stroke. And this is all before the Russia's invasion of Ukraine, which made it very salient for Americans that, well, maybe not even a company like McDonald's is safe in Russia. Even McDonald's had to disinvest from a lot of its hamburgers and fries production in Russia because of American sanctions. And so long as this prospect is out there that the Xi Jinping government is going to take the scalps off of a lot of Chinese entrepreneurs, or the U.S. government is going to sanction a lot of American funds as well as banks from investing more in China, I think that puts a pretty significant risk premium on China. That doesn't mean that it's completely uninvestable. I think if you read the analysis of my former colleagues at GovCow with Louis Gov, he is generally pretty bullish. But I am a little bit more concerned about political developments, and I'm pretty fearful of everything that could come from both Beijing as well as Washington D.C.
All right, well, let's keep that fear going here. To quote a Harvard guy, Graham Allison, "Are we destined for war?" Start me with, how do you see over the, you've studied President Xi, you've studied China, you live there. How do you see Taiwan unfolding over the next decade?
I don't feel like Xi is really itching to make a move on Taiwan. For the most part, I feel like the status quo is working very well for everyone, in which the Taiwanese functionally have quite a lot of independence. Beijing doesn't really feel like it needs to light the Pacific on fire and have a great conflagration around the island. And the U.S. is quite happy with the status quo as well. And I don't sign on to some of these views that one could see in D.C. that, they're driven by certain deadlines, that 2027 is the year, that's when they must do something like this. I feel like Beijing might do something like this if some parts of the status quo shifted in any big way. Now, I think that, so long as Beijing believes that time is on its side, that eventually, as in Beijing's words, the East is rising and the West is falling, if they believe that the Taiwanese nation is not able to resist the predations of the People's Liberation Army, if they doubt that the Americans are going to send significant troops into Taiwan to defend the integrity of this island, then maybe they feel like they don't need to move anytime soon. And so far, I feel like all of these conditions are likely to hold. They're trying to seize Taiwan is a significant gamble for Xi Jinping, because he cannot have confidence that the U.S. is not going to get involved, and the U.S. Extremely powerful Navy and Air Force is not going to be able to subdue the PLA invasion. And he feels that perhaps at some point the Taiwanese will desire to be part of the mainland. I don't see that has ha to be happening, but these are all potential scenarios that forestall any desire to initiate conflict immediately.
Well, I hope you're right, because it brings me to the, God forbid scenario, but let's say things get kinetic for whatever reason, that they don't care about the Silicon Shield, they don't care about the access to markets, or they feel like they have gotten a level of resilience, or they worry that the lessons of Ukraine are finally being appreciated in Taipei, and that maybe Taiwan is 2 or 3 years of defense development away from being able to resist, such that they have, it's a now or never. So God forbid we go to war. We won World War II, not least because we were the arsenal of democracy. But all of our war games now suggest we run out of stuff. One of the data points you have, and I've seen it elsewhere, is that in 2022, China was building 1,800 ships. The United States shipyards were building five at the time. That our monthly production of shells gets consumed every 2 days in the Ukrainian, Russian situation. If God forbid we go there, I still hope there are like secret factories or, you know, an ability to for the U.S. to kind of flip a switch and produce, but I don't have high confidence. If it, God forbid, came to that, how do you see a U.S. China, let's say, keep it non-nuclear war unfolding?
Yeah, I think the most important thing to try to do is to get up production. Now, I don't know if there is any secret factories. I bet there are not. But I do hope there's some secret technologies that the U.S. Navy and the U.S. Air Force hasn't really told the rest of us about. I'm sure that it has a couple of very strong capabilities. But if we take a look at the basics, it certainly doesn't look like the U.S. is doing very, very well. And don't take my word for it. Take the word of National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan under the Biden administration, in which he said publicly, if we had to face a near-peer adversary like the People's Republic of China, we will run out of munitions. And I don't know, how one can fight a war without having enough munitions. But the U.S. isn't producing very many ships, according to the Government Accountability Office. Every class of U.S. naval ships is behind schedule by 18 months to 5 years. The U.S. isn't being a great innovator in terms of drone production. The Ukrainians have been doing very, very well on this. And so, I think that there are some excellent weapons. I think that the U.S. is surely able to deploy. But let's get back to the basics here. And let's be able to produce important things like antibiotics. Let's be able to produce important things like shells. And I think this will be part of the crucial deterrence for China not to feel like it has the means and it has the confidence in order to really take Taiwan. So one of these things that I am nervous about is that the Chinese feel like they're in the position of, let's say, the U.S. Navy in World War II. There's a really wonderful phrase, quantity is a quality all its own, that's attributed either to Stalin in his with his Red Army flinging troops against Germany, or it is attributed to the U.S. Navy when the Japanese were building these highly exquisite aircraft carriers that were completely swarmed and overwhelmed by much more cheaply built and much more rapidly built American ships. And I fear that the U.S. is right now in the position of the Imperial Japanese Navy, in which every ship is really exquisite, but the Chinese can just build hundreds more per American ship. And you don't really want to be in that situation where you're one amazing ship facing off against 200 other ships.
Agreed. That is the risk that so many national security people that we talk to say as well. Just a few more questions. So hypothetically, you get invited to the White House. The administration is actually, let's make it National Security Advisor Rubio wants you to brief the president. What is your macro advice from all that you've studied and all that you've written, not necessarily just on war, but on, how to get the U.S. mojo back?
Let's reindustrialize. I think that's the first and most important thing. And unfortunately, given how much this president loves tariffs, we're not doing very well here. And I think the first thing to do is to get rid of the tariffs because I think have obviously been counterproductive in the data. We've had many months of manufacturing employment contraction as well as manufacturing production contraction. So at a first blush, this is not working very, very well. I think that the U.S. should stop attacking its science funding agencies. It doesn't make sense to try to make the U.S. a scientific superpower by cutting the budget of the NSF in half. I think that, for all of the problems in American universities, and believe me, I think they are real. I'm part of the Hoover Institution. I'm married to an academic at the University of Michigan. I see problems three times a day before breakfast in universities. But I think that there are good parts of universities worth saving, and we shouldn't try to destroy Columbia and Harvard in order to save the American educational system. And I certainly don't think that it is worthwhile to try to deport a lot of workers, to deport a lot of the workers that we need for our construction industry, for the manufacturing industry, not to frighten away a lot of high-skilled researchers. I have been fairly upset about this, the deportation of 300 South Korean engineers. I think that is going to really reduce appetite in South Korea, as well as everywhere else, to try to invest anything in the U.S. All of these people who are on visas, we don't really understand their situation, but they were here on visas. And, this is these are whom the Trump administration is really targeting. So the first thing to say is stop dropping, big heavy objects on our own foot. Let's try to be a little bit smarter. We should probably be inviting Chinese leading companies in something like batteries, something like electric vehicles, to produce more in the U.S. Rather than trying to keep them out. If the Chinese were able to do forced technology transfer to the Americans in terms of Apple as well as Tesla, why aren't we doing it to them? I would say that we should be much more welcoming towards workers. We should be much more welcoming towards researchers. We should generally still be investing more in technology production rather than less.
All good counsel. Last question. Has the book, I'm betting not, but I would ask, is the book been published in China? Are you allowed back in China? And are you hearing from friends over there who may or may not, if the book's not allowed there, maybe haven't had a chance to read it? But, I would imagine when you've got a lot of friends, you spent a bunch of years there. When you publish something like this, are you now persona non grata?
I have not tested this water yet. I have not yet been published in China. I'm hopeful to be published. I would love for my extended family. My parents are in Philly, but a lot of my extended family is still in southwestern China. I would love for my grandmother to be able to read what I've written. That would be wonderful. I suspect that if I were published in China, the censors would take big fat scissors to cut off probably half of my book. And if not scissors, then probably a big axe to basically trim my book in half. I'm hopeful to find a Taiwanese publisher. And later this year, I'll apply for a visa to visit China and just kick the tires and see what happens there. Yeah, and I'll make sure that people know that I've written this book. They have time to digest it. There's no surprises. If they let me in, if they give me a visa, I'll go. If they don't give me a visa, I won't go. So a pretty simple thing here. Bruce, before we turn over to questions, I want to ask you just one question. I was in Washington, D.C. Last week, in part to speak at the Abundance Conference. There's a lot of energy around abundance agenda. This is something I felt like the Abundance Conference was pretty optimistic. It felt really happy. There was a lot of energy there. It didn't feel very gloomy and Eeyore-like. And my book is cited now as part of the abundance canon. But you seem to know a few things about politics. Do you think that this abundance could be part of a movement to be more than a bestseller and also to be a movement?
Well, we had Derek Thompson on when the book came out. He's actually now, I think I've had him three different book events. He's a wonderful, I love that guy. I love his writing. And I love his thinking. The abundance debate, the battle is raging, particularly within the Democratic Party right now, as to whether or not they want to go harder core progressive left, or whether they want to embrace what I would argue a more pro-building, pro-moderate kind of what was once called a new Democratic agenda. And to the credit of the Democratic Party, it's diverse. It's a big tent. And there are people who see it both ways. Some see this as sort of just a big business in sheep's clothing. And others say, no, we're not going to win as the pronoun party. We got to be the party that, that applies the lessons that you talk about and that Derek talks about. So to the extent it feels like a movement, I worry that it's a room full of people like us, well-educated in the winner's circle, who all see the opportunity going forward. And that's One of my big takeaways, the reason we're seeing populism in the United States and we're seeing populism around the world is because the people who have been doing okay with free markets and with free trade aren't great at hearing from people outside of our own circles who are living very different existences, for whom free trade is the factory moving to Shenzhen and then all of a sudden, nothing replacing it in town, and so I don't get too excited yet because I think there is a big, the people offering it aren't necessarily trusted and aren't necessarily embraced. And they're really good ideas, but it so far feels like people who already agreed with the ideas all getting really excited about the ideas we all really agree with. And I haven't seen it catch fire. So Dan, I don't know if this is good news or bad news for you. I always invite people. I ask for about 45 minutes, and I pretty much have found that I end up coming up with questions and not opening it up. So you're about to get the rest of your afternoon back. And I don't say this merely because you and I disagree about, I don't support Yale. I don't support University of Michigan. I don't support the Eagles. So I'm not summarily ending you so much as here in town, it's almost dinner time. What I will say is we've got copies of Breakneck. I'm going to send a list around to a link around for people to enter their address. I think you guys have all gotten a taste of how smart Dan is. It's a great, great read. It really is smart and it's thoughtful. And I love that it hasn't obviously caused you to be excommunicated from China. I do hope they let you back and I hope they read it because there's a lot we need to learn and there's a lot they need to learn. And in a perfect world, we get better at building and they get better at human rights. Dan Wong, thank you for making the time and joining us.
Bruce, this was a pleasure. Thank you.
Awesome.